Turn again to the book of Daniel. We're going to be looking at chapter 12 this morning, and this will bring an end to this study. And appropriately titled, The Time of the End. They both go together. Next week, we'll begin a series in Proverbs. Probably spend 8, 10 weeks, something like that. There's a lot in Proverbs, and I'm looking forward to that. This chapter is a good transition between the two books, though. This morning's message is really a call to walk in wisdom. When we consider what God has said about what the future holds, and we will pay attention to that, we will walk in wisdom. And that is going to be something I'm going to emphasize throughout of this sermon. We cannot live properly in the present time if we're not mindful of where we're going. Our priorities will get skewed off in the wrong directions. So it's important that we understand where God is taking us. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15, the Apostle Paul calls on us to therefore be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time, redeeming the time because the days are evil. When we live with the future in mind, where God is taking us, then we set our priorities in the right place. We work toward the proper goals. Those who place their priority on the here and now, who live for the pleasures of the moment, who live for whatever they can gain, amass a lot of wealth, they're not wise. That's not wise. Now, godly pleasures are fine. In fact, God has given lots of things that are very pleasurable, and there's nothing wrong with enjoying those things. We should, and we should thank Him for them. But when pleasures become the pursuit of life, or when those pleasures themselves are sinful, it's evil. You're not wise. Proverbs 21:17 even warns that he who loves pleasure will become a poor man. The priorities get skewed off. 1 John 2:15 and 17 has an even stronger warning. Do not love this world, neither the things in this world. For all that is in the world, the lust of flesh, the lust of eyes, and the boastful pride of life are not from God, but they're of this world, and this world is passing away. When it comes to sinful pursuits, even when someone might seem that they might manage to minimize the consequences of those things, they're still going to be there. Because eventually there's no escape from God's courtroom, is there? Psalm 73 reminds us that, and then Revelation 20 tells us very specifically that man will be judged according to his deeds. You don't escape God's courtroom. Amassing of wealth is also a fine thing, as long as the means of acquiring that wealth is righteous and the purpose of it is a godly one. Now, I necessarily need to say that because we live in a strange time, even our own nation, when there are those who have taken the view that being wealthy is evil. I've always been amazed that when people say that, those who say it always manage to define up that those who have more than them are wealthy, they themselves are not wealthy. And yet, if we consider it, in fact, I had somebody send something by email this week, if you had a warm and safe place to sleep last night, if you got a couple changes of clothes that fit, if you've had a nutritious, warm meal in the last 24 hours, you're doing better than 75% of the world. You're wealthy. Do you believe it? You're wealthy. So it's not wealth is not the problem. It's what people do with it and their pursuit of it. Abraham was wealthy. Job had an immense amount of wealth, probably the richest man of his time. But both men were also righteous men, and they used their wealth properly. But when the means of acquiring wealth is sinful, or wealth itself becomes the goal, then you've stepped over into evil. That becomes a problem. Jesus warned us that we should not lay up our treasures here on earth, but instead lay them up in heaven. Why? Because if it's here on earth, it's easily destroyed. Moth and rust destroy it. Thieves break in and steal it. If our treasures are in heaven, it can't be touched that way. And where your heart is, or where your treasure is where your heart's going to be. 2 Peter 3:10 through 14 even describes the future destruction of the heavens and earth. We read that passage earlier. And then he gives this challenge. Seeing these things would be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and in godliness? You see, if we're really considering what the future holds, what ultimately we're going to be heading toward, we will make better decisions in the present, how we should live now, what our goals should be for life. If we don't keep that in mind, we tend to look at the present and think that's all there is. And then our sinful nature can take over and we want to grab and hoard. We become greedy. And that's not the purpose of life, is it? So let's consider Daniel chapter 12. And I think as we do, we're going to be motivated to walk in wisdom with the Lord. Don't let the pressures of this world conform you to its priorities. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind as you consider what God has revealed in His Word. Now, before we examine chapter 12, I need to give a brief review of chapters 10 and 11 just to set the context. Remember, in chapter 10, Daniel had been praying and fasting. And in response to that, God sent an angel to answer his prayer. Daniel was by the side of the Tigris River, and this angel comes and begins to reveal to him in chapter 11 the things that are inscribed in the book of truth. These are things that are going to happen in the future. Then in Daniel 11, 1 through 35, he gives a detailed description of the people and events, their past history for us now, but they were going to come, that really from that time until about 174 BC with Antiochus Epiphanes. Within that period, there's the rise of the Medo-Persian Empire. This is verses 1 and 2. There's the rise of Alexander the Great and the distribution of his kingdom in verses 3 and 4. Verses 5 through 21 detail the back and forth wars between the Seleucid dynasty in Egypt and Syria and the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. And guess who's in the middle? Israel. And that's the focus of the whole prophecy. But because these two nations are either side of it, when one would come in war against the other, they were always in the middle of it and constantly had problems. And so it details all this for us. Daniel 11, 21 through 35 describes a 10-year period of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, who usurped the Seleucid throne in 174 BC. He was a despicable man, and he prefigured the Antichrist that's to come. And then we saw there's a transition. We saw this 2 weeks ago in verse 35, because it ends without a time closure. It simply says that there is going to be a continuing purging and purifying of the Jews until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. Daniel 11:36 then picks up with this future individual that is so evil that Antiochus Epiphanes looks like a Sunday school student. He is utterly evil. He is the little horn described in Daniel 7 that arises out of the revived Roman Empire. He is often referred to as the Antichrist. The rest of Daniel 11 concerns him and that time period, as does chapter 12. That puts us in our context. We are looking at the period of Antichrist, and more specifically, the last part of his period. Remember, we saw in Daniel 9:27 that there's going to be a period of 7 years. That's the 70th week of that prophecy in which Antichrist arises. And in the middle of the week, it gets really bad. He proclaims himself basically to be God, and then it gets real bad. Look at chapter 12. Now, if you were Daniel to this point, it was probably been pretty disturbing. The future is going to hold some very bad things, and what's going to happen to Israel through that period and into this other period is absolutely horrible. Their continued rebellion against God is going to result in being oppressed by the Gentiles until the time of the end. And the people would suffer for centuries, their land between these two warring nations. there would come this despicable man. He would commit atrocities. He'd blaspheme God. And then he's followed by, at some point in the future, by someone even worse. Now, the fact that he would come to his end would have been of little comfort to Daniel. It's nice to know he's going to end, but this is a lot of nasty stuff that's going to go on. Now, if the revelation stopped there, Daniel's reaction probably been like the true previous prophecies. Very disturbed, weak, sick. Because it's just, it's bad. It's nasty. We don't even like reading about it. But the revelation doesn't stop there. We get chapter 12. And here the angel continues and reveals that God has a plan. He is going to protect a remnant out of his people, of Israel. And they would get through this whole period, and they will become part of the everlasting kingdom that's going to be set up that had been in the previous prophecies. Look at Daniel 12:1. Now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise, and there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. Now this is the same Michael that was introduced back in chapter 10, verse 13. Jude 1:9 specifically states he's an archangel. This is not Christ, it's not some other human or spiritual purpose. Person. His specific purpose, as revealed in this verse, is to protect and rescue this remnant of Israel whose names are written in the book. Now, this is referring to the Jews, is emphasized that twice in the same verse he used the phrase, your people. This is Daniel's people. These are Jewish people. Now, it's important to point this out, that there is no reference at all to the church here. There's no allusion to it. And that's despite the fact there's quite a few theologians, because of their traditions, that try and put the church there. The church isn't here. This is dealing with the nation of Israel and the Jewish people. The nation of Israel and the church are very distinct from each other. The church has not replaced Israel in God's prophetic plan for that nation, which is revealed throughout the Hebrew prophets. It still is his unique nation and people. And there's a serious error that has tried to replace that nation, those people, with the church. Historically, that has been the basis of past anti-Semitism and persecution of the Jews. In the present time, it's become foundational resurgence of anti-Semitism. Now, it is rising. Even now, there are quote-unquote evangelical leaders. We would call them evangelical in many respects, and this one, though they're wrong. They deny Israel's God-given right to the land, and instead they proclaim that the Islamic Arabs have the right to it. And they do not have that right, either historically or by right of war. But we have those now in the Christian camp that are again advocating against the Jewish people. It also needs to be pointed out here that Michael's activity, spoken about in this verse, concerns a particular time period. I pointed this out briefly a couple weeks ago. The phrase is now at that time. Now, it could refer to the end time back in Daniel 11, verse 40, and it could be understood to be concurrent with those verses and the subsequent ones in chapter 11, and there are those that advocate that position. However, the statement about a time of previously unknown distress, as mentioned here in verse 1, can only fit the latter half of the 70th week of Daniel's prophecy in 9:27. There is nothing in the previous verses that begins to compare with the great tribulation described by our Lord in Matthew 24:21-31, or the trumpet and vial judgments described by the Apostle John in Revelation chapters 8-16. Those will be events of proportions unknown in all previous history. Nothing compares to it. Jesus specifically describes this as, quote, a great tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. It is a unique time of unprecedented destruction. The references later in this section to time, times, and half a time, the number of days, also correspond to this latter half of the 70th week of Daniel 9:27. Now, there's been some questions to what Michael is actually doing in this verse, because some have misunderstood the term "arise" as in the New American Standard and some other translations. The King James, New King James, and Young's and Darby's do a better translation, saying this is, means stand up. He didn't arise, he stood up. Because that's the same verb is used twice in the passage, in this verse. The Ahmed and Hamed are from the same verb, Ahmad. Now, if you didn't understand, that's okay. They're both, they're two different forms of the same verb. Michael arises, or he stands up, in the sense of appearing or coming on the scene, and he takes his place to stand guard. That's what his charge is. And he is going to fulfill that responsibility in guarding and protecting the remnant of Jews whose names are written in the book. Now that's good news, and that's going to encourage Daniel. Yes, things are going to get bad, but God is faithful to his promises, and Michael, the archangel, is going to be very active in protecting this remnant, and they're going to survive this period and flourish afterward in the kingdom that will be set up that's eternal. From what we find in other prophets, Jeremiah 30, verse 7, Zechariah 13, 8, especially the Zechariah 13, 8 passage, we know there's only about one-third that will survive. But they will survive, and they will flourish. Now, the next verse would also be very encouraging to Daniel. Michael's there. He is going to do his job. He's going to protect this remnant. But what about everybody else that may have already died? He addresses that here in verse 2. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but to others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Now, resurrection is the great hope God has given to man, because without it, sin has not been conquered. Sin is still victorious because death comes from sin. The grave is final. Resurrection is pivotal for us. Job, which is probably the earliest book in the Bible, expresses that hope in two different places. In Job 14, 12 through 15, he expresses his hope that he's waiting for his change when God will call him. And he laments and despairs this life because it becomes so utterly miserable. Yet he has a hope beyond the present life. Then in chapter 19, verses 25 through 27, you have an incredible passage. Job 19, 25. And as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes shall see and not another. My heart faints within me. That was Job's hope. There is going to be a resurrection of his physical body. Resurrection was also the hope of Abraham. In Genesis 22, God called on Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, even though all the promises God had made to Abraham were going to pass through Isaac. He was the son of promise. Now, I realize that the Arabs at this point, who are descendants from Ishmael and from others, are claiming they are the ones who received the promise. Now, Genesis 17, 18, and 19 is extremely clear on the point. Even while Abraham pleaded with God that Ishmael might live before you, I don't need another son, Ishmael's enough, God said in Genesis 17, 19, no, but Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. The covenant goes through Isaac. How then is Abraham willing to offer Isaac as a sacrifice if every promise is bound up in Isaac? Well, first, Genesis 22 indicates that Abraham believed that God would provide a lamb. And he continued to believe that. But you know, he had to believe something way beyond that when he finally got to Mount Moriah, and he had arranged the wood, he had arranged the altar, he bound up Isaac, he put Isaac on the altar, and he raised his knife and was about to throw it down, and there still wasn't any lamb. Do you think he had to believe something else? He did. It was only at that point that the angel of the Lord called on him, Abraham, Abraham, stopped him and showed him that, yes, there was a lamb provided, caught by the horns in a thicket. Now, fortunately, we are told in Hebrews 11, 17 through 19, what Abraham believed. It said, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son, to whom it was said, in Isaac your descendant shall be called. He considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he also received them back as a type. Abraham believed that if he had to kill Isaac, God had to raise him back up to life, because that was the only way it was going to happen. That was his faith. Resurrection is pivotal for those who follow God. For Daniel, this is a great comfort. Not only would God preserve this remnant that would populate the future, but the righteous are going to be resurrected to join them. That's a great hope. Let me add something else here about resurrection. Resurrection and reincarnation are mutually exclusive. They both cannot be true. Either the soul is going to receive an immortal, incorruptible, resurrected body, or it will migrate from corruptible body to corruptible body for infinite time. It can't be both. It's one or the other. And yet, surprisingly, there are many professing Christians that say they believe both. That shows, one, a weakness in their biblical knowledge, and two, it shows how much influence Eastern mysticism has had on American Christianity. Resurrection is so important for Christians that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, 12 through 19, that if there is no resurrection, then we of all men are most to be pitied, because all the things we believe are false. But there is a resurrection. In fact, there are several of them. During his earthly ministry, Jesus raised several people from the dead as a sign that he was indeed the Messiah. You might recall some of these from your own reading through the Gospels. In Luke chapter 7, there was a young man that had died, and the funeral procession was going on, and Jesus stopped the funeral procession, raised the young man to life, and gave him back to his mother. That's my kind of funeral procession. In Matthew 9, Mark 5, and Luke 8 all record that Jesus raised up Jairus' daughter. Jairus was a synagogue official. John chapter 11 records the story of Jesus calling Lazarus from out of the tomb after Lazarus had already been dead for 4 days. Martha didn't want him to do it. Don't open that grave, he stinks. Open the grave, he's not staying in there. He called him out. Now, all those would have been temporary resurrections, since these people would have died again sometime later. The same also been true for Eutychus. He was a young man that when Paul was preaching late into the evening, got tired, fell asleep. He had been sitting up on a windowsill, and he fell down 3 stories and died. I know some of you think my sermons get a little boring, but I've not killed any of you yet. It's a good thing, because I can't raise you from the dead. Paul went down and raised the guy back up and then continued to preach. My kind of preacher. Now, they would have died again. There are also resurrections that followed Jesus' death at the cross of Calvary. In Matthew chapter 27, verses 50 through 53, it records there was an earthquake when Jesus died, and the tombs were split open. Then it says, many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. Now, since there are many bodies involved here, it's reasonable to think that included those who had been dead for some time, unless Jerusalem had a rash of deaths right then. And since they appeared to many people and they recognized them, it's reasonable to think that they probably hadn't been dead for so long that no one knew them. They were recognized by people. Wait a minute, I thought you were dead. I was, but I'm alive again. That had to be an exciting time. Now, the passage doesn't tell us if these were people who would have died again in the future, or possibly, maybe they received resurrected bodies. Their bodies had to have a lot of work done on it, because if you've been in the grave for, months and years, You know, there's a lot of work to get that thing working again. It's rotted. So they got something. Speculation, but perhaps they received resurrected bodies. They were translated to heaven later, just like Enoch and Elijah were. And then there's the resurrection of Jesus. He received a glorified, resurrected body that's immortal and incorruptible. That is the type of the resurrection we're looking forward to. 1 Corinthians 15, 20 and 23 describes this resurrection as the first fruits, which will then be followed by those who are Christ at his coming. So Jesus' resurrection is the basis of our hope in being resurrected ourselves as his redeemed followers. And according to 1 John 3, 2, though we don't know what our resurrected bodies will be like, we don't know all the details, we know this. They will be like Jesus, for we shall see him as he is. They're going to be a whole lot better than what we got now. Now, some theologians believe there's only going to be one future resurrection, but there's enough solid biblical evidence to conclude there's at least three, and possibly more, as specific groups of righteous are added to those who are going to be making up God's eternal kingdom. The first resurrection is described in 1 Thessalonians 4, 13 through 18. This is in conjunction with the translation of the living saints at the return of Christ, and they're caught up. We use the term rapture from the Latin. It just means that we're caught up with them at that time. That's what it says in the passage. There was concern among the Thessalonians that those who had fallen asleep in Jesus, and remember that the word asleep in all these passages is a euphemism for being dead. Their concern was those who had fallen asleep in Jesus are going to miss Jesus' return. And Paul then explains, starting in verse 15 of 1 Thessalonians 4, "For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord shall not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words." And there is a lot of comfort in those words, isn't there? Those who've already gone before us, they beat us. And how fast does that all occur? 1 Corinthians 15 describes it as the twinkling of an eye. That's the length of time it takes light to go through the lens of your eye, hit the retina, and reflect back. That's pretty fast. That we will be changed. Now here in Daniel 12, 2, there is a resurrection of the righteous to everlasting life. And there is also a resurrection of the unrighteous to disgrace and everlasting contempt. This occurs after the final period of the 70th week. Now, in this particular passage, it's debated about whether there's a real time separation here. But the time separation is very clear in Revelation. Revelation chapter 20, verses 4 through 15, explains about the future and these resurrections. And it makes a great distinction between them. The righteous are brought to life. In verses 4 through 6, it talks about that. And that occurs at the beginning of the millennium. The beginning of it. Then the unrighteous are specifically said they are not raised until the 1,000 years is over. And then they are brought before God at the great white throne judgment. It's 1,000 years later they are resurrected. So that's at least three resurrections. Daniel 3:12-3. The angel continued, "And those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven. And those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end of time. Many will go back and forth and knowledge will increase." There will be those during the time of this great tribulation that will have insight or understanding. And God is going to use them to bring the truth and righteousness of Jesus Christ to others. Certainly among these are going to be the 144,000 mentioned in Revelation 7 and 14. They are a blessing, and they are glorified for it. Daniel is told to shut up or close up these words and seal the book. That's not in the sense of shut this up and hide it so no one knows what's in it. This is more of the sense of preserve this for those who will come in the future. Do not let it become distorted. Make sure it's going to be there. This revelation wasn't given to Daniel for Daniel's sake. It was given for the purpose of those who would come in the future. And while there has been an increase in knowledge among future prophecy, because we've had more prophets, Jesus has spoken about it, and the apostles have all spoken about events to come in the future, there has also been an increase in confusion. People run back and forth, they learn all they can, and they end up confused by the many diverse and often contrary opinions by those claiming to be prophecy experts. The truth is that the prophecies of the future are going to be like the prophecies of the past. The details are not going to be understood until after they come to pass. And that's important. That keeps us humble. We can speculate, but make sure when we're talking about these things, we're saying this is speculation. Maybe this is a possibility. When we start becoming dogmatic about it, we're in trouble. We won't really know until after it actually has come to pass. That was one reason the apostles had such a difficult time with Jesus' resurrection. It was all laid out there for them. They just didn't understand it until afterward. Then it's like it all made sense. Starting in verse 5, the scene changes. The angel is now revealing, who had been revealing what was inscribed in the book of truth, is still there, but now there are additional angels. Look at verse 5. Now Daniel's still standing on the bank of the Tigris River. Then I, Daniel, looked and behold, two others were standing, one on this bank of the river and the other on that bank of the river. One said to the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river, that's the one that had been giving Daniel the revelation, how long will it be until the time of these wonders, or the end of these wonders? And I heard the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river. He raised his right hand and his left hand toward heaven, and he swore by him who lives forever that it be for a time, times, and half a time, and as soon as they finish shattering the power of the holy people, all these events will be completed. So Daniel notices two more angels, one on either side of the river. And one of them asks the angel who's above the river a question about the length of the time of these events. The specific reference here is to the time of distress mentioned in Daniel 12:1, this time of unprecedented distress. The angel then raises both hands toward heaven. He swears by the eternal God. He is the one that lives forever and ever. This adds a solemnity and an assuredness of his answer that it's going to be for a time, times, and half a time. Now that's the same phrasing that was used back in Daniel 7:25, and it corresponds to the last half of the 70th week in Daniel 9:27. It also corresponds to the 42 months that the temple and Jerusalem are going to be trampled by the nations in Revelation 11:2. It will be a time of severe persecution of the holy people, another reference to the Jews. That's God's holy people. And it says they're going to be shattered. That is why Michael, the archangel, has to be present to preserve the elect. If he wasn't there, they would be lost too. But when this persecution is finished, the Antichrist comes to his end, and no one is there to help him, Daniel 11:45. Now, Daniel doesn't understand, and so he asks another question, verse 8. As for me, I heard, but no one but could not understand, so I said, my Lord, what will be the outcome of these events? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for these words are concealed and sealed up until the end time. Many will be purged and purified and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand. But those who have insight will understand, and for the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. How blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains the 1,335 days. So the angel answers Daniel's question with a reminder and then gives him some additional revelation. First, he reminds Daniel, the revelation's not for you, it is rather for those who will be in the future. He is to preserve it. is to make sure it's going to be available. And Daniel was faithful with that endeavor, and that's why we have it today. The angel then reminded Daniel there would be a great time of purging the future, and it's going to separate the righteous, and they are the ones who are going to be wise, and they're going to understand. It's going to separate them from the wicked, who will continue in their wickedness and remain ignorant. That's another reminder to us that while we may have more emphasis in these prophecies than at Daniel's time, those who are in the future and will live through this will have a lot more understanding than we do. At the same time, we find here the wicked do not change. They continue in their evil, oblivious to the meaning of the events that are happening around them. They don't get it. It doesn't make sense to them. They're just going on. The angel then gives Daniel some additional time references which establish the outcome of these events, and that's going to comfort Daniel. But it leaves us with some unanswered questions. Daniel 9:27 states the stopping of the regular sacrifice and the abomination which makes desolate occurs at the middle of the 70th week. That's 3.5 years. The angel had just said the length of time of this great distress would be time, times, and half a time. That's 3.5 years. Revelation 11:2 and 13:5 both give the length of time as 42 months, which is 3.5 years. The temple and Jerusalem are going to be trampled by the nations, and the beast is going to speak blasphemies and have authority for that length of time. That's 3.5 years. 3.5 years is 1,260 days. What then is the reason for an additional 30 days, 1,290, and then having an additional 45 added onto that, 1,335? We don't know, because the text doesn't say. We can speculate. It may be that the additional 30 days is mopping up operations, purging out the remaining wicked. Matthew 13:41 may allude to that. There is a Christ comes, Antichrist is put down, he comes to an end, but you still have to get rid of everything else that had been part of his government. An additional 45 days after that, again, this is speculation, could be the time it takes to then establish the millennial kingdom, and some have suggested even that would be include the first celebration of the Feast of Booths in the new millennium. But again, that's all speculation. Those who get there will know. We don't. We can only speculate on that. The angel then tells Daniel in verse 13, "But as for you, go your way to the end, then you will enter into rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of the age." Daniel could be at peace in facing his own approaching death. Remember, he's an old man by this time. But he could approach his own death with confidence. The extra 30 days followed by the additional 45 days, he may not have understood exactly what that meant and their purpose, but he would have understood this. There would be Jews that would survive the Great Tribulation and will enter into the Millennial Kingdom, and it will be established at the conclusion of it. Time is not going to cease. The people of God will not be annihilated. They will continue. And for Daniel himself, he would finish his days in peace and then a hope given to him. He'd be at peace and be at rest, waiting to be resurrected at the proper time, and he too would receive his allotted portion in that future kingdom. So he could be completely at peace. Now, future prophecy can be both terrifying and comforting at the same time. I know that seems strange. How can you be terrified and at ease at the same time? Because the terrifying part, we look at these events in not just prophecy here in Daniel 11 and 12, but go back to chapter 7, chapter 8. There are terrible things that are going to be coming in the future. We know they're going to take place. God has said they're written in the book of truth. They're going to happen. And it is frightening in terms of thinking about what we might suffer as part of God's people, those grafted in who are going to suffer as that time comes closer. Now, Jesus already warned us that if we are going to be walking with him, we're going to be persecuted. That's part of the Christian life. We are the unique ones here in the United States because we're not persecuted like they are elsewhere. Many places, you become a Christian under the risk of martyrdom. And it may not be long between the two, baptism and being martyred. We know as the unrighteous gain more and more power and authority, persecution increases. That can happen here. It can happen very quickly. It's already been happening faster than I can believe. So that's scary for us. It's scary for us when we consider that we may have loved ones who will live beyond us and they could be end up in this period. And we'd hate anybody that we know having to live through that. And yet there's a comfort because we also find God's still in control even while Antichrist reigns and is allowed to have authority. He doesn't have ultimate authority. It's limited. God has already provided a protection for those who are written in his book. They are going to survive. And they will go into the millennial kingdom and populate it. And they'll be joined by the righteous who will be resurrected from the dead. That is our hope. That is the confidence we have in our God. And so to paraphrase the Apostle Peter, if seeing these things are going to be so, then what manner of life should you be living now, right now, in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming day of the Lord? Are you going to walk in wisdom or the foolishness of this world?